This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. This hour, we're talking about aquariums. Or is it aquaria? We'll try to get to the bottom of that burning grammatical question. Plus, we'll dive into the role of aquariums in both research and education. Millions of Americans visit an aquarium each year, and that may be as close as many of them get to a firsthand experience with marine life. But there's also a lot going on behind the scenes at aquariums, other educational programs, and also a deep involvement in research in many cases. We're going to take you behind the scenes to see what you don't see when you visit an aquarium, starting with the Woods Hole Science Aquarium. It's small and unobtrusive, but there's a lot going on inside, including a decades-old debate about who rightfully claims the title of the oldest operating aquarium in the United States. WCAI's intern Naomi Blinnick got that story for us.
The two resident harbor seals, Lucille and Bumper, may be the best-known residents of the Woods Hole Science Aquarium.
Bumper, can you talk?
But there is much more to this small, historic aquarium in the heart of Woods Hole Village. To learn more about the history and modern-day role of this historic aquarium, I caught up with George Lyles, the aquarium's curator since 2003.
My name is George Lyles. I am the curator at the Woods Hole Science Aquarium.
The aquarium began as part of the nation's first fisheries laboratory, founded in 1875 by Spencer Baird, the first U.S. fish commissioner. Baird was tasked by Congress to investigate the decline of New England's fisheries. He began his research in Woods Hole in 1871 and returned 4 years later to establish a permanent laboratory in a shed rented from the Lighthouse Service in the current location of the Coast Guard Station in Woods Hole.
That very first summer, they opened that lab to the public because Baird thought he had two missions. One was to do fisheries research, and one was to educate the public about marine environment and marine animals. So it was research and conservation from the beginning.
A big Victorian building was built on the current site in 1885 to house Baird's laboratories and collections, including the aquarium. After suffering heavy hurricane damage in the mid-1950s, it was replaced by the current buildings in 1960. But that's not what puts the aquarium's claim of oldest in the country up for debate.
The reason that there's another aquarium that claims to be the oldest aquarium in the country is there is another aquarium that claims to be the aquarium that Spencer Baird founded in Woods Hole in 1875. And that aquarium is in Washington, D.C.
That would be the National Aquarium, which claims that Baird moved the aquarium to the nation's capital in 1878. As the Fish Commission was renamed and absorbed into other federal agencies over the next 50 years, the size, location, and scope of the aquarium changed as well, until becoming established in the bottom of the Department of Commerce building in 1932. These days, it is operated by the National Aquarium in Baltimore.
And they claim to be the oldest aquarium because they claim to be us. But we're us. We never left Woods Hole.
Baird's Fish Commission was the forerunner to the National Marine Fisheries Service, which is part of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA. The Woods Hole Science Aquarium is run by NOAA, and it is the only aquarium they run, despite having offices around the country.
It's here for the historical reasons. It's here because Spencer Baird thought that if the public's paying for science, it ought to understand what science it's getting.
These days, the aquarium receives 80,000 visitors annually, including 7,000 to 8,000 school children. Visitors come from all 50 states and up to 70 countries.
Despite having a fairly large and varied collection, it is not a very big aquarium. And if you're expecting New England Aquarium or Mystic Aquarium, you get to the end of the walkthrough on the visit and you might wonder where the rest of the aquarium is.
A lot of what the aquarium does goes on behind the scenes. It provides research support for studies on New England marine resources, animal rehabilitation, and provides a wide array of programming for elementary through university students. Every year, high school students from all educational and economic backgrounds come from around the country to spend a summer interning at the aquarium. Interns gain hands-on experience in animal husbandry, explore local ecosystems on field trips, and discover marine science being done in Woods Hole via collaborations with local scientists.
Having diversity in the program, we think, is really important, and we're really happy that if you look at our collection of 15 or 20 high school students who will be here this summer, they look like the American population. So we're trying, and I think we're succeeding at serving the whole country with our little aquarium.
In the grand scheme of things, Lyles hopes that visitors will come away with a greater understanding and appreciation for the often unseen inhabitants of the North Atlantic. He compares a visit to the aquarium with what a New England family might experience on a visit to a national park out west.
We've taken the kids to the Grand Canyon, and we've looked at that beautiful national park, and we've looked at it and thought, wow, this is our canyon. This is a really great canyon. These are our redwood trees. Well, if you live in Kansas, these whales that are up here and these cod that are up here in these waters, those are your whales and your cod.
For the Cape and Islands NPR stations, I'm Naomi Blinnick in Woods Hole.
And here in the studio with me is George Lyles, curator of the Woods Hole Science Aquarium. Welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, you're an English major. Answer the question for us. Is it aquaria or is it aquariums?
I don't know. That would require more research.
I have to say, after 7 years of Latin in junior high and high school, it feels a little odd. But you were saying you tend to go with aquariums, I guess?
I say aquariums because it sounds better. And I'm from a descriptivist, not a prescriptivist background on language. So I think language is how people use it. Most people say aquariums.
All right. Well, we'll run with aquariums for the time being, and we'll ask our other guests later in the show to weigh in as well. For that matter, maybe one of our listeners knows. If you can tell us the difference between aquaria and aquariums, please fire off an email to livinglabradio@wgbh.org, or you can find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. Now, George Lyles, the title of the aquarium here in Woods Hole is the Woods Hole Science Aquarium. What's the word science doing in there?
Well, we're run by the National Marine Fisheries Service in partnership, I should add, with the Marine Biological Laboratory. But we were founded by Spencer Baird, originally here, as you heard, as part of a working science lab. So we're really not about entertainment. We're about trying to support the mission of our agency, which actually National Marine Fisheries Service in Woods Hole is known as a science agency. But the reality is we are a resource management agency. Our resource management is supposed to be based on science, and here in Woods Hole, we do the science portion of what the National Marine Fisheries Service is responsible for. So we're a science agency. We're a small aquarium run by a science agency, so we put science in our title.
So the aquarium has essentially three missions, research, conservation, and education. What is I know research offices just above the aquarium. What is the relationship between some of those fisheries researchers and the aquarium? Are they actually using the aquarium for research?
A little bit, sometimes. Our historical missions were the research and education portion. The conservation came later, not until near the end of the 20th century in the 1990s. But originally, we were education and research. The research component is basically, it's a very small, I mean, mostly we are an educational facility, but the research that we do is we have tanks that we make available to people who are doing science and primarily people who are doing stock assessment. So sometimes people who are tagging animals keep tagged animals. These animals are not on display. The public doesn't see them. They're in the basement. We make research space and tanks available to scientists who are doing stock assessment work. We occasionally do other research. We were doing a piece of research which was on display with the state, with the Commonwealth. They were checking to see whether or not the tags that people put on horseshoe crabs last throughout the season until the horseshoe crab molts, because it's important to know whether or not a horseshoe crab has already donated blood once. So we did a research project with the Commonwealth on that.
So for those who haven't actually been to the Woods Hole Science Aquarium, give us a little tour of the collections. What do you see when you walk through the aquarium?
Right. Well, right now we have about 100 species of animals. Sometimes we have more. We have up to 140 species. We display all animals that are found in northeast U.S. waters. Northeast goes from actually Cape Hatteras up to the Maine border. Most of the animals you see in the aquarium, actually all the animals you see in the aquarium, do get into New England waters. So as you come in, you see the animals. We have three water systems, a cold, a temperate, and a tropical. As you come in, you see the cold water system, and you see the ground fish, the cod, which we are Cape Cod, so we put cod in the first tank. And then you can also see the temperate water animals, and you can see the tropical animals. They are in our waters summers only. They ride the Gulf Stream up. It's a one-way trip for them. The turtles and whales that come up at the end of the summer, they're big enough and strong enough that they can swim back down to the southern waters in the winter, and they do that. The fish that ride the Gulf Stream up, like I said, it's a one-way trip. They're not able to get back down, so they perish in the fall. But they're here. So they're not local in the sense they don't reproduce here, but they're local in the sense that they're out there every summer. So we display them also.
I mean, when we're talking tropical, though, we're not talking about there are no coral reefs at the
Woods Hole
Science
Aquarium.
No, coral reefs.
No. We're just talking about some of the fish, some of the angel fish, and so forth that ride up on the Gulf Stream. So that's part of what you see when you come in. We also have some exhibits, non-living exhibits, that show some of the work scientists do. Using sound at sea and aging animals, trying to figure out how old animals are. We have a display of turtles, which is one of the popular things, our huge life-size model of the leatherback turtle. Then one of the other popular features of the aquarium is you can go in the work area in the back, which is pretty unusual for an aquarium. So you go up in the back work area and you can see the staff getting the food ready for the animals or cleaning the tanks. We have a touch tank in that area where you can touch animals. And then, of course, the most popular feature is we do have two harbor seals. We feed them most days at 11 o'clock and 4 o'clock. And when we feed them, we do a narrated feeding, so you get to learn about harbor seals.
I have to say, the being able to go behind the tanks is one of my favorite aspects of it, to be able to see the tank from the front and then kind of see what it takes to keep those tanks going, I think is a really interesting educational experience in and of itself.
People like that. And a number of years ago, we actually wrote up a master plan for the aquarium. And that was one of the, and we asked people what they liked about the aquarium. And that was one of the things that was most popular about the aquarium. So for the staff, trying to get our work done while the public is there is sometimes a little bit difficult. But we're committed to doing that because we know that's popular. People also, when they're watching the staff do its work, can then talk to the staff. And we have a fairly friendly staff that's happy to explain what they're doing in terms of cleaning and feeding and so forth.
Now, I know education is really your passion and one of the reasons that you're at the aquarium. Tell us about some of the educational programs that the aquarium runs.
Right. Well, we're a self-tour educational facility. So we have, like the intro said, about 80,000 people a year and 5,000 or 6,000 or 7,000 school students a year. And you can come through the aquarium self-tour. The programs that we run, we have a program of collecting walks for the public in the summer, which is sign up in the lobby, and we take people out to Little Sipowicet, and we do a collecting walk there, which is mostly catch and release. Occasionally we find something we bring back and put in the collection. So we have that program. The seal program, the narrated seal feeding, is an educational program. We try to explain to people what our relationship should be with marine mammals and what we're required by law to do, which is stay away from them and leave them alone, and what to do if you see a stranded seal. Then we also have the intern program in the summer. We have student programs during the winter with a number of partner schools. We have a program with the Upper Cape Regional Tech, and we have a program with a couple of Boston-based schools. And then in the summer, we have a program which is not with schools. It's with individual students. We bring in high school students. We have three different programs where the students come in and spend anywhere between 2 and 5 weeks working with us in the aquarium.
So what is that experience like? I know that some of the interns are actually arriving today. What are they in for this summer?
The ones that are arriving today are going to be there for 5 weeks. There's just three of them. One's a young man from Florida, one's a young man from Boston, and the other is a young woman from central Massachusetts. And they'll be with us for 5 weeks. They'll learn how to take care of the animals. We will train them to be naturalists on the collecting walks so that they'll help us with the public on the collecting walks. And then they'll also participate in a two-week seminar where we have them introduced to different areas of science. So we have scientists from MBL and from the fisheries and from HUI come in and talk about the work they're doing. And then there's usually a hands-on follow-up. So someone will talk about stock assessment, and then they'll go over to the lab where scientists try to determine the age of fish by looking at scales, so they get a chance to do some hands-on work.
So is it's almost more of a research internship, it sounds like, as much as an aquarium internship.
It's a career exploration internship is the way we look at it. We try to introduce high school students to a variety of research or career possibilities. We have economists on the staff at National Marine Fisheries Service, so I have an economist that comes in and talks to them about their work. I mean, who knew that in Woods Hole there are economists? We have on the staff at the Fisheries Service, we have anthropologists. I mean, who even knew that there were jobs for anthropologists? But if you're an anthropologist and you're interested in fishing communities, you should think about the federal government, because we have jobs for anthropologists. So I view the high school program as a career awareness program.
Now, I know you actually have kind of a personal issue with the term intern. You don't like some of the connotations, especially the way that interns have been perhaps abused in other segments. But you say you think this is actually a really good program that's breaking down some of those barriers, maybe.
Well, there's a national discussion going on now about intern programs and the use of interns, which some organizations use interns to get work done without paying them, and naturally people are a little concerned about that. Our interns, our so-called interns, are students. It's entirely an educational program. We don't bring people here to get work done. We bring people here to try to open their eyes to some possibilities that they didn't already know about. The other problem with intern programs, and it is a problem with programs like ours, we don't charge anything, but we also don't provide any compensation. So there's no stipend. It's no cost to do the program, but you have to be from a family that can afford to somehow house you in Woods Hole. And you have to be from a family where you can take 2 to 5 weeks off in the summer and not earn any income. A lot of students need some income during the summer. So there is that problem with programs. We try to run our programs so that they will be accessible to students from all different backgrounds. And so we try to work hard to make sure that our intern or our summer programs are not programs that, that narrow pathways, but that open them up.
You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. We're talking this hour about aquariums, the education and research programs you don't necessarily see when you're walking through. More after a short break.
You're listening to WCAI, the Cape and Islands NPR station.
Welcome back. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. In case you're just joining us, we're talking about aquariums, their role in both education and research. Here in the studio with me is George Lyles, curator of the Woods Hole Science Aquarium. And joining us now by phone is Dr. Michael Tlusty, director of research at the New England Aquarium. Also, Dr. Paul Boyle, senior vice president of conservation and education with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, glad to be here.
Hello, good morning. How are you?
We're doing well, thank you. I want to get you guys to both weigh in. I guess it is the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Is aquariums the appropriate plural here, or is the Latin aquaria is just out of the picture at this point?
You could, either one is correct. They're both acceptable uses. I tend to use aquariums because it sounds more like everyday talk, but aquaria is correct also.
Okay, I think my my too many years of Latin in high school is showing through. The aquariums somehow is still a little rough coming off the tongue, but we will go with aquariums. That seems to be the consensus. We're also asking our listeners this hour for their thoughts on the ethics of aquariums. Do you think we should keep animals in captivity for educational purposes? Or if you keep a home aquarium, do you make an effort to ensure that your hobby doesn't negatively impact the environment? Send us an email at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook and Twitter. Now, Paul Boyle, zoos often take pride in housing rare or endangered animals, you know, the last of their kind, that sort of thing, and also being involved in husbandry efforts to perhaps supplement those populations in the wild. Do aquariums perform that same function?
Of course they do. You've been talking a lot about research, and you know, nobody ever built a major aquarium for the purpose of doing research, but once they exist, they have just amazing capabilities for research in terms of what you just mentioned, the live animal collection. There isn't anybody on the planet more capable of keeping animals alive and healthy than the aquariums that you're talking about. Certainly the Woods Hole Aquarium has been in the process of doing that for many, many decades, into the past couple of centuries, I guess. And so I think that's probably one of the first efforts that aquariums have gotten into as they've been built. So back in the 1800s, they were those sort of menageries for people to view these odd animals from around the planet. And yet in the past, I would say half a century, that has moved into very important research that's being conducted by these institutions, all the way from the basic biology. A lot of the basic biology of the animals that we know about actually occurred in collaboration with aquariums around the world. And today, the aquariums like New England Aquarium in Boston and the Mystic Aquarium and many others are involved in very serious-minded research beyond their own walls, looking into everything from climate change to the cognitive capabilities of marine mammals, and then how do we keep endangered threatened species from being lost.
Now, Michael Tlusty, the New England Aquarium, I know, is very active in rescue and rehabilitation work, particularly with turtles and marine mammals. Tell us a little bit more about that program and how the rescue side of things interacts with perhaps the resident collections.
Yeah, the rescue and rehabilitation, it is an important part And actually, we've moved all of that operation to an offsite holding facility down in Quincy. You know, some of it is occasional. The idea is to get those animals out back to the wild. A lot of what we work on are Kimberley sea turtles, which are an endangered sea turtle. And so the idea is to take animals that, you know, through a cold stunning event would not survive and actually make sure they remain in the population. And so that, the idea is actually not to have that interact with our exhibit stream that much, and that we don't want the turtles ending up in captivity. We want them remaining in the wild. And that's, you know, the ultimate goal of any rescue and rehabilitation program. Now, those animals that are sufficiently injured, you know, we will put on exhibit. But again, we try to keep those to a minimum.
Now, George Lyles, are any of the animals in the Woods Hole Science Aquarium endangered species?
We display Atlantic salmon, which is an endangered species. The animals that we display are not part of the endangered population. They're hatchery fish. That's the only one we display. We also participate with New England Aquarium on the turtle rehab. They do the critical care of the animals, and once the animals are stabilized, they send them out to various aquariums, and we take a few of those turtles every year, and they get their follow-up part of their rehab with us before they're released.
And, of course, the beloved seals that are out front are both rescued seals, right?
They're both rescued animals. They are not endangered. Seals are protected by the Marine Mammal Protection Act, but they're not endangered. But, yes, the two that we have are non-releasable.
Now, Michael Tlusty, how does the rescue work relate to research efforts that are going on at the aquarium?
Well, we publish a lot on the values of the animals coming in. You know, this actually, especially like with our Kemp's Ridley's work, it gives us an interesting ability, and that's to actually work with a, you know, threatened and endangered species. If we intentionally went out and wanted to get blood values of these animals, it would actually be very difficult from a permitting standpoint. But because of the
Michael, we're having some trouble hearing
you. So we can actually work with these animals, and it's not to supersede a permitting process, but it's actually just another route to work with these animals. And so, you know, all of our animals come in, we take blood values, we look at them, and we work with them from a research capacity as well.
So basically, during the rescue process, you're actually doing some research as well, gathering data, gathering samples, that sort of thing.
Yeah, and a lot of this is to actually put out values of sick and injured animals so we can... So in the next go-around, you know, we know what's the blood value of an animal that's most likely to survive and what's the blood value of an animal that's likely not to survive. And it helps with the triage process a little bit easier.
Now, are there actual research efforts going on using the in-house collections, or is it mostly this field-based research?
No, we have a great number of projects going on with our animals in-house. And some of these are just basic breeding efforts. A lot of the fish we have on exhibit actually do breed, and a lot of them we've never reared in captivity, and there are some actually really big challenges to doing so. So we're working on that. We do have some animals. I have an American lobster laboratory, and we're working on shell disease, which is a problem the lobsters show in the wild, and so we're actually working on it from a captive standpoint.
Now, Paul Boyle, would you say that most aquariums across the country, I know there are well over 100 aquariums at least, are most aquariums involved in research efforts like this?
I'd have to say no, although in terms of improving the husbandry, the keeping of animals, virtually every aquarium is involved in that kind of work. New England Aquarium, the Mystic Aquarium, certainly the Woods Hole Aquarium, and a number of others are involved in these ongoing research efforts that that literally go beyond their own walls or go deeper into the science, as Michael's been discussing with you for the past couple of minutes.
Now, I'm curious, how much interaction is there? You know, you're from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Obviously, there's some, at least philosophical overlap in terms of being institutions that keep animals, captive animals, and for public education. But how much interaction is there between zoos and aquariums?
Oh, there's a lot of interaction. It's a network of institutions, and the one common feature is the accreditation process that that AZA, my association, manages. It's the most stringent accreditation process in the world. And these institutions that have gone through it have evidenced their very high standards for animal care, animal husbandry, animal welfare, and on through every aspect of operating the organization.
Well, we'll get more into some of those issues, the ethics and some of the sustainability issues. But Michael Tlusty, I'm curious, where does the funding for this research come from? Is this actually something that visitors to the New England Aquarium are essentially paying for these research efforts with their admission fee?
No, very little of the of our research monies actually come from our gates. We are all soft money scientists, so we have to independently raise money, and you know we actually kind of operate under an academic model, and we do actually have a number of partnerships with local universities, where we do work with graduate students and the like. So it's so most of the admission fee to our aquarium, you know, pays for the care of the animal, pays for the education programming, and our research. You know, currently we have Sea Grant funding, we have NSF funding. We're actually doing an interesting NSF project because we know how to rear animals so well. We're working with ocean acidification and larval fish and actually looking at some of the impacts that can have.
So why did you, or why would a scientist choose to be, say, at the New England Aquarium as opposed to at one of these academic institutions?
Oh, for a number of reasons. I mean, you know, we have over 2,500 species in our building, and it's an amazing biodiverse collection. So, you know, I can walk out of my office and go look at behavior in any number of fish. There's also, I'm actually very interested in the home fish hobby trade. And so there's a great deal of overlap between the species we hold on exhibit and the home aquarium trade. And the interesting thing is that we looked at the number of imports of live marine fish coming into the country, primarily for the home trade. And in a single year, we found 1,800 species coming into the country. And the collection of a lot of these species actually maintains these remote socio-ecological systems, you know, these coral reef communities, that if they weren't collecting fish for the aquarium trade, they would actually be out collecting fish for the food trade. And there's a lot of similarities. One of the big differences is they're getting a much higher value for the fish they collect for the aquarium trade. And so you can actually provide economy to these small rural communities through the aquarium fish trade. And so this is the thing we're trying to work on, is how do you maximize the benefits of the trade to these rural economies. And there's cases where you want to bring fish out of the wild and produce them in aquaculture, but there's other times when you actually want to leave them in the wild and do a sustainable harvest of those fish. And then the last piece of that is, you know, we have people that are willing to spend disposable income to look at fish, and that's great. It's a great learning opportunity. You know, we're working on how do you communicate messaging around climate change and, you know, ocean health into that. And that's where the home aquarium comes in the trade, because that's kind of the gateway to science. You know, a lot of researchers nowadays grew up being tropical fish hobbyists when they were little. And so, again, we see that as kind of the gateway drug to science.
Aquariums is a gateway drug. I'm not sure that's a phrase you would typically hear.
No, that is not. And I actually, now that I said that, I regret saying it. But it is the gateway to science. It's a fantastic way to get kids involved in, you know, basic hypothesis testing into, you know, cause and effect. If you overfeed a tank, what happens? You know, and a lot of this, you know, aquariums are many ecosystems, and it's thinking about, you know, population density and feeding and, you know, interactions between different species. So it's a fantastic way to get young kids involved in science.
Now, we've been talking a lot about the animals, but of course, as you're talking about ecosystems, these ecosystems in the wild obviously are going to involve plants as well as animals. But I don't feel like you'd necessarily see a lot of plants when you come to an aquarium. What about plants? Where are they in our aquariums? George Lyles, do you want to take a stab at this?
Sure. Our plants are plastic, and there's a reason for that. We want to focus on displaying animals, and we don't want to have to think about what the water needs are and what the light needs are for plants, because we're focusing on animals. Obviously, plants are really important in the environment also, but our mission is to display the animals. So,
is that just because that's the more charismatic side of things, that people want to come see the animals, and so that's what we put front and center?
I don't know. I never really even thought about why there aren't aquariums that display plants. Probably some of the aquariums do. We want to focus on the animals, so our plants are plastic, and we don't have to worry about the conditions they need. And when we want to clean a tank, we can take our plants out and stick them in bleach, and then put them back in the water, and we're good to go. So we're about displaying fish. Your other experts on the line here, they probably know there probably are aquariums that display marine plants.
Paul Boyle. The one that comes to mind most notably is the Monterey Bay Aquarium, and they actually have live kelp in their larger tanks. But I think the majority, as George is pointing out, focus on the animals, and the marine plants, the algae, have really high demands, and the way that they're able to keep the kelp alive at Monterey is there, that large tank, that enormous tank, because Monterey Bay is actually very clean water, the tank is just a flow-through tank. They take water in and they release it back out, and I think that's one of the reasons that they're able to keep live kelp alive. It takes enormous amounts of sunlight, or in their case, they have skylights above that tank as well as lights to keep the algae alive. So they're tough. It's tough to keep marine plants alive and doing well.
You're listening to Living Lab on The Point. We're talking this hour about the role of aquariums in education and research. We'll talk more about the ethics and sustainability of aquariums after a short break. Welcome back. This is Living Lab on The Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. My guests this hour are George Lyles of the Woods Hole Science Aquarium, Dr. Michael Tlusty of the New England Aquarium, and Dr. Paul Boyle from the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. We're talking about aquariums, their role in research and education, as well as issues of ethics and sustainability. We'd like to hear your thoughts on the subject. Do you think we should keep animals in captivity for educational purposes? Or if you keep a home aquarium, do you make an effort to ensure that your hobby doesn't negatively impact the environment? Send us an email at livinglabradio@wgbh.org or find Living Lab Radio on Facebook or Twitter. We have a couple of emails here. Jenny writes that many folks have interactions with nature on a much smaller scale, especially if there are kids around. Naturally, if we transmit mindfulness and respect, the experience is so much more valuable. That bucket of crabs and minnows on the beach needs to stay cool, and also fish can go into shock and die if handled. Spiders and other bugs need a few water droplets in their jar. A toad can live happily in a terrarium for a while and eat bugs, but the frog must be released very soon. So there are issues here to think about, you know, even as we're going out into the wild. You talked about the home aquarium as this entree to the science, and obviously we've talked also about some of the collecting trips that the Woods Hole Science Aquarium runs, that getting people out onto the beach, there's going to be this temptation to maybe pick up some of these animals and take them home and start an aquarium. How realistic is that? George Lyles, go ahead. Can we just pick up things off the beach and take them home and start an aquarium and expect that to work and be a positive experience?
Yeah, it's probably not going to turn out real well for the animal that you take home. I see kids at the beach with animals in buckets. I think that's a great thing. We have a touch tank. We let people touch animals in our aquarium, and some places have stopped doing that. It's not great for the individual animals that are being touched. We ask them not to pick up the animals, but just to touch them gently with two fingers. Even that, it's not great for the animal that's being touched. So it's hard for people to take animals home from the beach and take good care of them and have that turn out well. On the other hand, when you look at those children looking closely at those animals and interacting with those animals and starting to learn about those animals, I view that, or touching them in our touch tank, I view that as people on their way to having an interest and an understanding of the marine environment, that they're going to be good stewards of the marine environment because they're having that experience.
We also got an email from Becky. She said, I just wanted to talk a little bit about how valuable a small classroom or kitchen aquarium can be as a learning tool as well as endless entertainment. As with a large aquarium, the most important thing to consider is maintaining animal health and water quality by not overloading the tank with organisms, by changing out the seawater frequently, and by not overfeeding. For my kitchen aquarium, I only collect hardy organisms that can tolerate some fluctuation in salinity and temperature and water quality. It's fun duplicating an organism's natural habitat and watching behaviors. My goal is that the organism feels so at home in the tank that they go about their normal behaviors without stress. In the classroom, I would like to keep an aquarium journal next to the tank where the kids could write down observations and thoughts about what was going on in the tank. Now, Michael Klusky, are there any recommendations you can give as a home aquarium hobbyist and enthusiast yourself that you could give to people who are interested in having a positive aquarium experience at home?
Yeah, I think, that last email pointed out a few critical factors. You know, one is don't overload a tank. You know, keep things simple. I've worked with actually my son's school. He just finished middle school, and we would put aquariums into the classroom. And a lot of it is, guppies are great. Great animals, and you know, one of the really cool things is, you know, you put in two males and four females, and inevitably they will breed. And so it's actually bringing, you know, this reproductive cycle into the classroom. And for any biology classroom, I mean, that's fantastic to have the kids basically see babies right there in front of them and grow up. And it's a great experience. And again, you can use, you know, those six guppies, and maybe put a catfish down on the bottom, or go shrimp also work good because they will also breed in an aquarium. And this is something that is a very low maintenance system and very easy to do. And you know, just to go back to the point, two of the earlier points. One is about collecting animals. When you're collecting animals off the beach, if you're in Massachusetts, those are cold water animals, and, you know, inevitably it's usually temperature that gets the animals in the end if they try to bring them back in. One of the problems with collecting, Massachusetts animals is they would need to be chilled in some manner.
So we always
actually going back to a previous point, we talked a little bit about saltwater plants. At the New England Aquarium, we have our freshwater gallery is actually all real plants, and the aquarist there just does a fantastic job with it. And freshwater plants are actually a little easier to do than saltwater plants, and you can do some really awesome planted tanks. And there was a movement in Germany a long time ago to actually do real plants, no mechanical filtration at all, and the plants were basically, and you would actually do these mini 20-gallon ecosystems complete, and it would just be one or two fish, you know, maybe a crustacean or two on the bottom, and plants, and the idea was to have an intact closed ecosystem that they would recreate. So there's actually some really elegant things being done with planted aquariums.
Paul Boyle, the Association of Zoos and Aquariums is accreditation through your organization is probably the gold standard for aquariums. There are plenty of great aquariums out there who are not accredited because the standards are so high. Could you tell us a little bit about what those standards are to become an accredited aquarium?
Sure. They cover literally every aspect of the institution's operation, all the way from the things that you would guess quickly. So the education programs, husbandry standards, attention to animal care and welfare, but also even the financial stability of the institution. Does it have the wherewithal to continue to run very high-quality education programs, to pay close attention to the ongoing care and the sustainability of its collection, and so on? So it literally, the accreditation process goes through every area of operation to ensure that these are the institutions that sort of, as you said, meet that gold standard, but can really pay attention to the higher parts of the organization's mission. So education, conservation, research, activity, engagement in those activity, to be leaders in the field.
Now, coral reefs, I know, are something that everyone, I think, who goes to an aquarium wants to see a coral reef. Obviously, not everybody can, in their lifetime, have the experience of going out and diving on a coral reef. And so that's one of the wonderful things about aquariums, is they can take you someplace you wouldn't be able to go otherwise. But corals can be, as I understand it, very difficult to propagate in captivity. And we mentioned earlier the whole aquarium trade and the fact that there are island nations in the Pacific whose economies are kind of built around going out and taking chunks of their coral reefs and selling them for aquaria. So how sustainable is this practice of actually having corals in aquariums?
Actually, this is Michael. I'd like to jump in on that for a minute. You know, most of the corals coming out of Indonesia are actually farmed. They're growing, so they do take a mother colony from the wild, but then they actually, it's called fragging. You break it into little pieces and you grow it up. And it's actually interesting. There's when we track wildlife trade, we do have the country from which it originates put down if it's a wild or a farmed piece of wildlife. And in the case of corals, it's actually, for some of these small island nations, it's actually really hard to go through and demonstrate that these things are being produced in aquaculture or mariculture. And so actually there's, in the Solomon Islands, one of the largest coral producers, he has wild quota, so he can go out and wild harvest product, but he's basically, he's actually producing all of his corals in mariculture, but he ships them as a wild product because it's easier for him. He doesn't have the resources necessary to do all the demonstration that it's an aquaculture product. So this is actually where some of our wildlife trade falls apart, in that we're not getting the complete story. We're actually growing these corals in culture, but then the way they're coming into the country, they're actually being labeled as a wild product. And then people get very upset that we're going out and we're harvesting all this live rock. And so, you know, there's some gaps in the way we actually track our wildlife. And that being said, it's actually, we're doing a much better job of being able to grow corals in culture. And I know here at the New England Aquarium, we have a number of tanks with live corals, and we actually work closely with the Boston Reef Aquarium Society, and to not only share knowledge with what they know, but you know, so we do work closely, and you know, as much as we can, we're trying to integrate captive coral culture into it. So not all corals are actually just being taken off the wild. A lot of them are actually grown in culture.
Well, that's certainly good news. Staying with the corals for another moment, as carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere rise, corals face a real threat from the problem of ocean acidification. There have been some predictions in recent years that we could see the demise of actually a significant portion of the world's coral reefs as early as 2050. Are aquariums going to be in the position that some zoos are now, of housing perhaps the last examples of some of these coral species? Paul Boyle, do you want
to... Sure. It's hard to predict. You know, the changes that we're seeing in the ocean today are going to, even if we stopped adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, those changes are going to continue for decades. So there's a lot of attention on how bad ocean acidification is going to get. And you know, corals, I think, are an iconic animal, much like people point to polar bears as sort of an icon of the effects of climate change. So if anything is possible. The ocean's a big place, and there will likely be small places in the ocean where corals will persist. Certainly their skeletons will persist. We hope that we don't lose corals, but I think there's a lot of the aquarium world is part of the front edge of teaching people about the changes that are going on in the ocean. And that education mission is just of enormous importance in terms of helping people sort out, which is climate change has been politicized so much that some of the research that I do actually on people's attitudes and motivations through an entity called the Ocean Project is teaching us that the public largely views climate change as a political topic as opposed to a scientific topic now. And New England Aquarium certainly is a leader, along with the National Aquarium and the Monterey Aquarium, in trying to sort through the process of how we can simplify the message for the public to better understand what is happening with climate change, what is happening with changes in the ocean and ocean acidification, and how they can be part of the solution. People can be part of the solution.
Michael Tlusty, you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I did. Thank you. The one thing, some of our acidification, and this is where actual benchtop lab research with animals helps, we're actually looking at cases of where if you just do and change the acidification of the water, and in all other ways you take care of animals fine, they actually do well. And so, one thing we look at is this idea of multiple stressors. It's not just the acidification, but it's increased nutrification, and it's changes in the food web that then don't allow the animal the ability to compensate fully for this other change. So a lot of our research groups, at the aquarium we have 11 PhD PIs, principal investigators here, and a lot of us do focus on just not a single stressor, but these multiple stressors. And, again, an animal can handle one stressor fine, but you start adding two or three stressors at the same time, and that's when they really have problems. And the one thing is, with climate change, that complicates a message. And, people do like this very simple message. And so it is that we're changing the oceans, and acidification is the main driver, but it's not just because the water is acidic that the animals are having problems. It's because that the water is acidic and their food is changing, and the temperature is changing, and there's all these ways in which we're impacting it. And that's where the animals really have trouble in maintaining their life.
So in research terms, have we learned things from the captive animals in an aquarium that we couldn't have learned otherwise?
Oh, yes. I am. A very simple case is we were the first aquarium, and we were the first research group ever to spawn our queen triggerfish spawned. This is a pair we had on exhibit. They were building a nest, and we just happened to grab the eggs. We were the first research group to ever rear a triggerfish species of any type in from a captive spawn and all the way through to a fish that we could actually put back in our exhibit.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. We are running out of time. George Lyles, curator of the Woods Hole Science Aquarium, Dr. Michael Tlusty, director of research for the New England Aquarium, and Dr. Paul Boyle, senior vice president of conservation and education with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks all for listening. Until next week, this is Living Lab on the Point. You can find Living Lab Radio all week on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone.
Amy Vince produces The Point. Mindy Todd is executive producer. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.